if you were, I don't know how intently you were listening to the Bible reading. I don't know if that goes over your head or if you really tune into that bit. If you were listening to it and you had to give the Bible an age certificate, I wonder what age certificate you would give a piece like that. I would suggest to you, and I talked to a few people about what I was preaching on in the week, and they all said to me, I wouldn't be able to watch it if it was on the television. I wouldn't be able to watch that. Some of the content that we are given in that half a chapter or in the broader Bible would be an 18, I think. Maybe there's a different system. I think you still have 18s where it's just you'd have to think really seriously about whether you would watch this content or not. But grading, I think, is a complex thing, isn't it? Maybe you've had moments when you've been wanting to watch something, maybe particularly with the family, if you gathered as a family, or if you've been very conscious, if you've got your Christian conscience on and you're watching a film, and there's a moment in the film and you think to, maybe you're very conscious, you jump in front of the television if you're watching it with kids, and there's a dodgy bit, and you ask yourself, is this going to be worth it come the end of the film? Is it going to make this worthwhile? Because to get the message, often, with films and what we watch, you've got to see the truth. To really get it, you've got to see the difficult things, the things that are hard to see, the things that often make films 18s. So to see the healing, you've got to sit through the abuse. To get the healing, you've got to sit through the abuse. To get the light and the hope and the joy, you've got to sit through the darkness and the despair for it to really resonate. So maybe you've seen Schindler's List, this incredibly meaning film, this incredibly important film, this really rich film that conveys a really important message for us today, a really important message now, for our world now. But to really get it and to really feel it, the director said you've got to sit through some of this awfulness. You've got to see it. It's got to resonate with you. And yet, when we think about what's happening with the Bible, God gives us a book. If your loving father sat you down, like bearing all that in mind, and stuck an 18 on, here's what I would suggest to you. It's either not your dad, he doesn't care about you, he's not real, doesn't care about you, or there is something really, really desperately important that he wants you to see. God gives us, in his wisdom, I would say, he gives us content that is really hard for us to get our head around. He gives us an 18, and it is not idle, him doing this. And it means, I think, we're left in a conundrum, because often we get to the good book and we just open it up. I've had a few quiet times this week where I've just opened it up and I've just kind of read it, and I've not really retained hardly anything that I've read, and I'm a pastor. And I think God gives us a book that we either say, that's just look at the content of that. We either say God doesn't love and he's not there, or we say God has got something desperately important to say to us. God has got something to say to us about life and about love and about light and about hope. He's got a message to convey about where we are that we can't get around and not hear. So God gives us an 18. So now I'm going to go through as quickly as I can the 18, and I've got a little screen to help me out. And the reading, it was a really long one, so we've missed bits of it off. Me and my daughter, okay, this is a complex scene, but it might help you. I didn't imagine it like this when it was up there. This will help you understand, this is a family affair. Okay, so David is the dad and the king. Absalom and Tamar, our brother and sister, share a mum and dad. And Amnon is also a part of that family, but he's got a different parent. He's got a different mum. The guy on the right, he's the shrewd politician. So just keep these people. These are the main characters. This is a desperately dark story, but keep these five characters in view. And remember, all the way through, it's a family affair, and this is the family up here. So it starts off, and you can maybe just see this in verse 1. We can flick back and forth through the story. Amnon says he's in love with Tamar. He says, I'm in love with her. If you've got any kind of a conscience whatsoever, you should have alarm bells ringing. And we're supposed to see that the alarm bells are ringing at this point. Now, Tamar, the text takes time to set out the picture for us and to understand the picture. Tamar is beautiful. and Amnon's watching. And Amnon gets increasingly lusty and increasingly predatory as the text goes through. She's beautiful, and she's not only beautiful, you can see in the text, she's a virgin. And in these times, in her situ as part of the royal household, she would have dressed as such. She's a beautiful woman dressed as a virgin, sharing space with a predatory, lusty, horrid guy. And as the text goes on, we see what this, he can't cope with it. He's looking, and it's so horrible, is the text, as you read it through. The line that jumped out at me most was, I mean, it says he's obsessed, and it says he's frustrated. Those are the lines he used. But when I read that he sees her, and he's annoyed that he can't do anything with her, we have a sense of how horrible a kind of guy this is. There's a picture of kind of entitled objectification that we know today. We know that picture. Could it be any more creepy? I'm not sure if it could. Then we have Jonadab, and he's described as being, so this is in verse 3, he's described as being shrewd. I think you could see that. Now, Amnon had an advisor named Jonadab, son of Shimea. David's brother Jonadab was a very shrewd man. The more I've read around that word, I think there are more connotations to his shrewdness. He's not just that he's clever. He gives the impression of kind of a slippery politician. You know, somebody who has, and I had a few, I didn't want to go down the road, but there's a few politicians that jumped into my head. Really clever people who are able to answer questions, but not always for the good of the people, if you know what I mean, if I can be so bold. Sometimes for the good of themselves or for the good of their party. I think spin is one of the words that we use to describe it, self-prospering. And he is the advisor to David's family. And so Amnon goes to him, and the advice is not wholesome advice. It's creepy, looking after my own back advice from Jonadab. I've got to read it to say it right every time that I look at it. Look at what he suggests. So this runs through verse 3 to 7. Awful advice. He says, in a nutshell, fake an illness, get her, via David, he uses David as kind of a conduit to get this message across, to sort of leverage it, get her to feed you, and then very bluntly, just pull her into bed, something like that. Here, by the way, in verse 7, we get the first glimpse of a bit of a recurring theme in this chapter. David has a chance to intervene. He has a chance to see what's going on. You read the text and you think, surely he smells a rat and he knows what his son's like. But think back to the story. David starts to go missing. David has a chance to intervene at this point, and he doesn't do anything. And then we get one of the most awful scenes, I think, in all of the Bible, perhaps. One of the darkest corners. Verse 11 through 13. It's a rape scene. It's an 18 that is played out in front of us. But when she took it to him to eat, he grabbed her. And he said, come to bed with me, my sister. And I think here, when you get to verse 12, you realize that her pleas sort of amplify just how evil a moment it is. You get to really sense just how dark it is. The way that she reacts to this moment just lets you know how sinister Amnon is. No, my brother, she says to him, don't force me. Such a thing should not be done in all of Israel. Don't do this wicked thing. Break your heart moment. What about me? Where could I get rid of my disgrace? And what about you? You would be like one of the wicked fools in Israel. Please speak to the king. He won't keep me from being married to you. But he refused to listen to her. Do you see how desperate that whole situation is? She says to him, think about me. In those times, in those circumstances, even though she's completely the victim, she's going to be ostracized. She's going to be the one that's marred. She's going to be the one that won't be able to stay. She's going to be the one who's going to have to hide away. And she says, think about you. Think about your legacy. Your legacy is going to be ruined. Think about this whole thing. Will you think about this? And then I think in an ultimate desperate plea, she says, maybe my dad would let us get married. I think maybe just to get him away, just to stall him perhaps, or maybe it's a representation of just how desperate she is in these times, that she'll do just the fact that even if he takes advantage of her, being married to him would be better than just being raped by him. Do you see how horrible it is? And then there's perhaps an even darker line, the realities of it, but because he's stronger, he raped her. And the outpouring of that, and we get a bit of a reflection of the, we think he's bad already, but then we realize what's at play. What does he do after that? After his dark act, he kicks her out into the street. And I thought at first that that was just because he hated himself, but then as I talked to people about this kind of situation, I realized that it was more than that. It was a power thing. He was trying to keep the power. The end of the first sort of scene, Tamar is marred forever. And what you've got to think about, this is the family scene. These all once ran around in the same house. David looked at his kids and thought, these are all my kids. This is my inheritance. This is happy families. Tamar's marred. Absalom is ruined with hate. He's filled with hate, fueled with hate. And David, crucially, the king, he's furious. You can see that in the text. But at no point does he do anything. We didn't read through the second part of the text. Let me just summarize the story for you. Maybe you could pop the text up, verse 23. Absalom's hatred. It's a funny thing, hate, isn't it? Time does heal. We know that. Hate doesn't always go away, does it? If you get stuck in hate, you can be just as hateful towards somebody years down the line. In fact, sometimes hate can fester and it can get worse. Absalom's hatred is worse. It festers and he hatches a plan to kill Amnon. So in verse 23, you'll have to just jump up there and check out the text. He invites all of the king's sons for a night out with the, and I see the sinisterness in this, with the sheep shearers. I'm going to use those inverted commas, sheep shearers. He invites them for a night out with the sheep shearers. What the heck's that? That's where he's going to meet his end. Verse 24 through to 26 again. Read through that with me. David again has chance to intervene, but does nothing. Absalom went to the king and said, your servant has had the shearers come. Will the king and his attendants please join me? No, my son, the king replied. All of us should not go. We would only be a burden to you. Although Absalom urged him, he still refused to go, but he gave him blessing. Then Absalom said, if not, please let my brother Amnon come with us. Do you see what he does? David's right there. David's seen this mess unfold. He's the king. Surely he smells a rat. Surely he should do something. But he does nothing. And Amnon, we read, is murdered. Then we go back to our old pal, Jonadab, again, as the text draws to a close. There's a report that all of the king's sons dead, and this creepy political advisor puts his arm around King David, and he just whispers in his ear, oh, no, not everybody's dead. Just Amnon is dead. He's a guy who knows exactly what's going on. He's got the smarts, but his smarts aren't for the good of the people. His smarts are purely for himself. The story ends. Amnon's dead. Jonadab's got off with it. Absalom is ruined by hate. David is numbed with grief, numbed to do nothing. And Tamar is marred. Joyous story. And maybe you're saying to me, Ash, I could watch the news and be this depressed. I don't need to come to church. I was enjoying the singing before where I felt like I got a bit of a lift. What is the message? And what I would say to you is it's an 18. It's a crucial message that we get. First of all, the first thing I think that the text does, do you see the way that we see Tamar? Do you see the way that we get to see her and her plight and her circumstance? The first thing that I think the text calls us to do is to feel, and the Bible calls us to do, is to feel the injustices of the Tamars in the world. I don't know about you, but I get compassion fatigue. Do you get compassion fatigue when you're looking around at all of the stuff that's going on? Forget the world around us, just even on your street. Compassion fatigue. We get cynical about people in difficult circumstances, and God's word would speak to us. And it would say to us, see the vulnerable. share their pain. Don't give up being a compassionate person. Don't rule that out. Stay soft. This wonderful verse that comes out to us is guard your heart, because everything that you do flows from it. Don't let that be ruined. Don't let that turn to stone. And I try and say that really delicately, because I feel like to survive often in this world, you've got to turn to stone a little bit. You've got to switch off the telly because it's too much, isn't it? God says to us through his word, I think, see the Tamars, say soft, but more than just see them. Do you see all the characters in this story? Do you see what they're telling us? See the Tamars, but know, I think this is the weight of the text, know that there's nobody in all of Israel, in all of God's kingdom, who can actually help and do anything. It's where she should be, in God's order, the safest she could ever be. In Israel, amongst God's people, in his family. And yet, look who we have there. The Bible text tells us that nobody is quite complete enough to look after her. Jonadab, he's got the smarts, he's got the wit and the intelligence, but he's got no principles. Absalom, who killed Amnon, remember, he's got the zeal. He's got like the fire in his belly, but he's got no righteousness. David has got the position and the authority, but he doesn't act. What I would say is today, whenever we see injustice laid out before us, whenever there are vulnerable people on our news or in our midst, these four characters, one way or another, are all still at play. And the cycle of injustice repeats itself. There's always, think of any circumstance that just pops into your head right now that's unjust in the world. Something from the news, something that you've seen in your workplace. There's always these people. It comes back around. There's always somebody taking advantage. Always somebody taking advantage. Always that. There's always somebody who gets so filled up with hate by the whole thing and then does more damage afterwards. There's always people turning the situation to their own ends. It's always the smart, slimy politicians, and it's not just the politicians. There's always somebody who's in a position to act and who doesn't. But the Bible story doesn't end there. It's an 18, but this is just half of the story. To see the hope and the joy and the light, the despair and the darkness has got to be allowed to resonate. Sometimes, certainly when I read my Bible early doors and I saw Jesus and I saw that all of his crowd were made up of dropouts and vulnerable women and prostitutes and this kind of thing, I wondered, why doesn't Jesus start at the top and get a really tight crew of important people and then his message will spread? Why does he go around like this? Why does he build this sort of team around him? What is going on here? A couple of stories that I think really, really beautiful when you have this 18 backstory of this lady Tamar in the back of your mind and you see that she is ruined by the actions of abusive men, particularly. When you read through the accounts of what Jesus does, I think we see hope like we don't see anywhere else in the whole world, is what I would say. So one story that jumped as I was reflecting on this, one story that, and they're all, every encounter he has, they're all beautiful, but one story that jumped out at me, there's a story of a woman who had a bleed for 12 years. She lives in Israel. Now, if she's got a bleed for 12 years, she's an outcast in society through no fault of her own. She can't go anywhere. She's always hiding, always beaten down, and always going to be vulnerable. And Jesus is urged to rush past her. He's in a crowd of people pushing past her. And yet he stops. He stops and he sees her. He stops and he sees her. And he doesn't take advantage. He doesn't twist words to his own end. He heals her. And she goes from being somebody who is outside, an outcast, praise God, to somebody who can live again inside a community. Another wonderful story, and they are many. There's a lady who is caught in adultery. So she's not even, I don't know how the you look how far back you look into the story, technically, I guess you would say maybe she's not even innocent in this moment. And yet Jesus sees her. He's in a position as a teacher to do something. One of the most beautiful things about Jesus is every time that we see him in a position to do something, and I think back to all the millions of moments in my life where I've had a chance to do something and not, and Jesus always does something. He always does the right thing. He makes an intervention. And if you remember the story, he speaks to the crowd and he says, "Let the person with no sin throw the first stone." His words, his wisdom, he's got the smarts, but he doesn't use it, his smarts, to get himself off the hook. He uses it, his words and his wisdom. In fact, actually, when you think about it, he puts himself more in danger when he opens his mouth. But it's to the benefit of those who are vulnerable. He acts to save. He doesn't take advantage, but he helps. He always uses his position for good, his wisdom for others. His zeal is righteous, and his love is always true. And he says to us, watching thousands of years later, with compassion fatigue, thinking that there's no point doing anything, he says to us, beautifully, this is the way. This is the way. And we say, is it? And then we watch him go to the cross and prove it. And when they put him on the cross, we remember that his words mean that he's condemned. And everybody else gets to go free. We remember that he's in a position that he completely abandons and gives up all of heaven's glory, the safety of wherever he was. And he gives it all up so that people might go free. His words are for others. His love is true and his zeal is right. And when he's raised from the dead, we see enough. The world, I would say, sees enough to go, yes, that is the way. And he calls us. I've been really put under the fire with this week, I guess, as I've reflected on these words. He calls us to do the same. He says to us, this is the way. This is the way through. This is the only hope. And I believe as he was hung there on that cross in that way, the world saw a light in a sense that will never go out. The hope will resonate forever. And our consciences are pricked forever. And we say, yes, we have to watch our words. We have to use our words for others. If we have chance to do something, then even if we have to do it, we have to work on our zeal, not to let ourselves be ruined by hate, but to be moved by righteousness. We see enough to always have hope. That's the first thing I think that we see. Lastly, when we see this situation play out, we look at David's family and we think God's finished, I think. You look at that story, all that God's been doing through that family and through those people, you look at that circumstance and you think, surely that's all gone to pot. Surely God's just given up with that. God can't still be there. They're kicking lumps out of each other. They're killing each other. And worse. And yet you read back a few chapters and what you realize is God is right there in the middle of it. This has been the sermons for the last couple of weeks. There's going to be consequences for the sin. God is going to work to redeem this family. God is going to work in and amongst this chaos. God is at work in and amongst this chaos, and he will present us with a Messiah through this family. God is still there working away. Now, when we look at our world around us, and this is why the Bible needs to be an 18, I think, because we see how dark it is, we see how much craziness is going on, and tell me I'm making this up, tell me it's not just me. Every now and again, you look at it and you go, God must have given up. He must have given up. And then you sit down for a second and you see Christ, you see him on the cross, and you see his word to us, whether you're reading through Romans or whether you're listening to the parables that Jesus talked, and you see that he's saying, this is how it was going to be. You give in to sin, this is the pathway. Read through Romans 1. or the parable of the weeds or any of those kind of things. Jesus says, this is how it's going to be, but he also says, to his glory, I've not given up. I'm still at work.